Brian Collins, we have 45 minutes to get into a quick version of your life, who Collins 1.0 was and who Collins 2.0 is going to become, or perhaps is already. But before we get into that, I imagine the majority of whoever is listening to this knows who you are already. They know everywhere you've come from, what you've created, the brands that you've transformed and the businesses that you've changed. But I want to quickly go back and get an understanding of talent, because this is called Untalented. Yeah. And I want to know who the first person was that made you feel like you had talent.
Super clearly, my parents. I grew up in a community and a town and in a family that loved the arts, loved music, loved theater, loved opera, loved all of it. So I was very clear that I liked things like drawing, dance, theater, music. I loved to dance as a kid. I ended up taking dance lessons as a child. My parents and my family and my aunts encouraged that. In fact, to the point where I was as a child, I think, you know, I became, or I guess I became a sissy by conviction, because I wanted to be different. I remember going into the fifth grade and I remember watching, I loved Fred Astaire musicals and I loved MGM musicals from the 1930s and the 40s and the 50s. And I remember like seeing a scene with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and Fred Astaire or Cary Grant would wear like ascots, or they would wear these you know, super expressive neckerchiefs. And I remember going to my aunt, who was a seamstress. I said, could you make me one? So my first day of school in the fifth grade, I would show up with the big ascot.
Wow.
And I did. And the first day of school was like on a Thursday, and I went to Friday, and I saw my aunt that weekend. And I told her that the boys in the sixth grade kind of beat me up a little and pushed me around because I wore this big orange ascot. And she said to me, well, that doesn't make any sense. This is what we're doing. And she lived in Milton. She said, we drove into Boston, which is where there's giant fabric stores. And she had her favorite, the owner of the store, she made him pull out all these giant bolts of fabric. So you remember, it's the 60s. Mm. And so these incredible colors, like yellows and psychedelics and pinks and purples and oranges. And she said, select the colors you want. And she made me five more ascots.
Wow.
And she said, if you back down now, you'll always back down. So she made me five ascots, and on Monday, I wore a new ascot. On Tuesday, I wore a yellow ascot. On Thursday, I wore a paisley ascot. On Friday, I wore a purple ascot. And anyway, I wore ascots Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Here's the interesting thing. On Monday, the kids kind of pushed me around. Mm. On Tuesday, a couple of them pushed me around. On Thursday, they made jokes. I'm sorry, on Wednesday, they made jokes. On Thursday, they went, eh. Friday, they ignored me.
Wow. Okay.
And so people ask me, why do I wear an orange hat? I wear an orange hat because when I was 10, I showed up in the fifth grade with an orange ascot. I have a picture. I have my fifth grade portrait because they took your portrait that day.
Yeah.
It's me. I'm standing there with a bright red shirt and an ascot going. And my aunt encouraged me. She said, do not back down because they don't like what you do. Do you like that? I'm like, I love it. Then we're going to make five more.
I find this really interesting. Okay. Malcolm Gladwell, Outliers. There's this whole idea of early reinforcement, early confidence. The whole thing of like, why are basketball players, the ones that are born in September, there's a correlation between, because when they were younger, they had early confidence to do that thing.
Yeah.
Like, how does that then translate? So you then, you know, you become this person that has, and was that consistent, the confidence throughout teens into 20s, and then when you came into the professional world? Did that, because normally you hear this story curve of, I was told I was different when I was younger, I struggled, I then shied away when I became sexualized, 14, 15, I didn't know who I was. Throughout that time in your childhood into the commercial world, did you maintain or did you waver that confidence?
Once, but what's really interesting is when you're a kid and you realize that you think differently than other kids and you are different. Like, I would prefer to stay inside and read and write and draw and watch old musicals, then go out and play, you know, 10-year-old boys turn a game of kickball into blood sport. Like, I don't want anything to do with that. The girls made much more sense. They like to go on picnics, so I go on with them on picnics. Girls made much more sense to me. And so you learn how to be alone with yourself. Mm. And so I became very comfortable with sort of being alone with myself, and then also then keeping an eye out for people who might have been like me. Mm. So kids who like comics, kids who like poetry, kids who like science, kids who like to paint. They're often introverts, but I end up building an alliance of nerds in junior high school. Kids who are really fascinated by the things that fascinated them. And so, but the other thing is you have to learn is you have to work in the context of a larger social environment. And I learned very early on who the bullies were. I could pick them out fast. And what you do with a bully, you either get upset by them or you make them your friend. And so I would find, I'd have a sense of who the bullies were, and I would tease them to their face, but in a friendly way, and mock them, and I would make them laugh. And a bully, like a laugh is going to stop a punch every day. And when they're laughing at you, or even laughing with you, they're not going to make fun of you, and they're certainly not going to beat you up. So I had no problem being an outsider. I never had this, they didn't understand me. I'm like, they didn't understand me. Great. That meant I could be kind with them and then go off and do what I did. And then by the time you're in junior high school and high school, you know, the kids who were the bullies or whoever they were figuring out their own stuff, you know? And then I always created space for them, and in turn, they created space for me. So I never felt like I was the artistic outsider. I'm like, no, it was I. And so the ultimate way for being both the insider and the outsider is I was curious about community. I was curious about how bigger communities operate. So I ran for class president, you know, in a class of about 700 kids against the captain of the football team, the captain of the basketball team, the captain of the baseball team.
Wow.
And then, you know, the head of the art club.
With this.
With a... and I won. That was very funny.
It's not the story I was expecting to hear.
I was an artist and my class president. I don't see those things as contradictory. And many people do.
It's just rare to see that happen. You normally hear of the outsider artist. I want to bring this into...
No, being an outsider, I like being an outsider insider. Mm. Because I knew that that I was in a part of a larger community. Mm. And I also knew that I had deep interests in film, animation, events, theater, music. And when you're a class president, you get to program the things you wanted to do. So I had a film series of musicals that kids turned out to, and they loved it. And I could program rock bands that I really liked, and they liked it. It turns out I was a pretty good programmer for events, and we made a boatload of money. And I had a good class council and whatnot, but I liked being the kind of organizer of that stuff. I wanted everybody to have, I wanted everybody to enjoy themselves. When you're not seen as a kid, and in some cases I wasn't seen as a kid, it creates an understanding of what it's like for other kids or other creative people or even bullies not to be seen.
Is that what you then went on to create? So like, I mean, the quick skip through this is you started your own design agency really young. That was the first thing you did within the creative industry. Went onwards to then, I think, launch again. And then you became a CCO or chief of design at Ogilvy, which was an ad agency at that time, still is today, and then on to FCB and then into Collins.
Yeah.
I've skipped through the whole journey there, but I want to know at which point you felt like you had something different and therefore had the, I guess audacity is the fair thing to say, having never worked at an agency before or a design company, to then launch your own. What was what gave you the confidence to do that?
What would you end up doing? It's kind of interesting to look back because I've been at this for such a long time. I'm always fascinated by larger and larger and larger and larger worlds.
Yeah.
After I figured something out, I'm like, well, what else can I do? And where's the next step? Or where's the next mountain? Mm. So by the time I got to like one mountain, I already had my eyes set on the next one.
Okay.
I never stayed very long where I was. I'm like, okay, I got this figured out. Now what else can I do? Oh, I got that figured out. Now what else can I do? So what can I do? So start your own design firm. I was invited to go to work with conceivably the one of the finest design firms in the world in Minneapolis, at the Duffy Group, which is part of Fallon, one of the most remarkable advertising agencies. Oh, they were agency of the year that year. And then from there to work at an even bigger agency that was on, like, it was very powerful on the West Coast. Their clients included Disney and Amazon, and I was a creative director on Levi's. So I'm suddenly working on a global brand. And then I get a call from Ogilvy to go help lead 20 global brands, from IBM to the Ford Motor Company to Unilever to Jaguar. And so these are larger and larger worlds. Mm-hmm. And then I remember in the lobby bumping into Shelley Lazarus. She's the CEO of Ogilvy and Mather. And she said, hello, Brian. I said, hi, Shelley, where are you going? I'm going off to the World Economic Forum. I'm like, I didn't know what the World Economic Forum was. Where's that? In Davos. Oh, have a good time. And I went back to World Economic Forum. I'm like, the heads of state, the leaders of the world all go to Davos, Switzerland to talk for a week about the future. I'm like, wow, I want to go there. So, but you don't apply to go. You get invited to go. Because it costs, it costs hundreds of thousands.
Wow.
They invite you to pay. And it's a handful of the world's leaders, including heads of state and celebrated CEOs. And I bet that's an interesting place to go. So I ended up making a speech about 2 years later. Somebody from the audience was from the World Economic Forum. They said, would you like to come to the Zinn IPS and have an evening with us and talk about the world of design? I said, sure. And I didn't mess up. And they said, we would like you to be our guest at the World Economic Forum. Would you like to come to Switzerland? And I went back and I went there about off and on for about a decade, talking about the power of design as an agent of change.
This is before you launched Collins.
No. Yeah, this is before I launched Collins. That's correct.
Wow.
So all of a sudden, I guess I'm always fascinated, but where else?
Yeah.
Where else are interesting conversations happening that could help shape design?
Yeah.
And it kind of tracked with the career that I had. I was first introduced to, my family called it commercial art. My neighbor, who was an architect, introduced me to the term graphic design. And he worked for Walter Gropius, the founder of the Bauhaus. Then by the time I get to college, I'm studying communications design because it was all about communications. Mm. Then by the 80s, it's called corporate identity. And then by the 90s, it's called brand identity. And then certainly within the last 20 years, it's been called branding. So all of these expansive expressions all incorporate what came before. Like graphic design is clearly a part of branding, as is communication sign, corporate identity, brand identity, right? So as my area of my profession expanded, its understanding of itself, my career also sort of evolved in larger ways. And I always thought that was interesting. So it's always been fascinating to me. I'm like, well, where else can we go?
Yeah.
What else can we do? I had no interest in staying in my studio in Boston, I made a logo, I made another logo. I'm like, do people love that? And I admire people who do that. But I did that for about a year. I'm like, okay, what else can I do? So I was always more fascinated by larger and larger questions.
I want to ask you, I was with someone yesterday who said...
By the way, I still do like making...
Still logos. Well, logos. I mean,
yeah.
I can imagine.
But in much larger context.
I was with Nick Law yesterday.
Yeah, I love Nick.
Who said he's worked with three designers that he will always say, I mean, I think best designer he's ever worked with. Johnny Ive, a chap called Virgilio, and then the third one was Brian Collins. Nick's worked with... Millions of designers.
Nick has to get out more.
But he holds you in the same regard as Johnny Ive, right? And that, for those that don't know, is the guy that invented pretty much all the best Apple products. Mm-hmm. What was it about you, and this can be either practice, theoretically, what was it about you that made people that, like Nick, who are formidable creative leaders, say that kind of stuff?
Say what kind of, what do you mean?
Well, you're a top three designer compared to Johnny Ive. What was it about you that was so remarkable?
You have to ask Nick that. I think Nick is being generous, but I really like Johnny. The first time I met Johnny, we were looking at a project I was doing. I flipped open my laptop and there was a scratch on the surface and it was an Apple laptop. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. And Johnny turns to me and goes, no, I'm sorry.
That is incredible.
Isn't that great? So like, I should have designed it. So I didn't do that. What was interesting for me is I'm really fascinated. You know, so I've looked back across all of that time. Mm. Right. I think Nick and I will have this in common because I think the world of Nick Law. I think Nick and I have this in common, which is, what's the biggest question we can answer with the puzzle that we have in front of us? Mm. Like whenever we get an assignment is, what's the largest thing that we can do here? And what I realized, whether it's my evolution from graphic design to communication design to corporate identity to branding and all of those things, I went back and I looked at, what is it that we're really doing in all of those disciplines, right? And we realized what we're really doing, which is the conversation that we want to make about where Collins is now going. Mm-hmm. Our real value isn't in branding. Our real value is in driving transformation. So creating change. Brands and organizations and companies, even people, you're either a step ahead of the culture or you're 16 steps behind. If you're not ahead of it, you are sliding fast.
Yeah.
And culture changes so quickly that companies have to keep pace or keep ahead, actually. So if you're not keeping it, if you're not ahead, you're way behind. So companies, therefore, are not just branding and organizing and making things constant, but you have to be in a place where you're constantly transforming. So we realized the things that we've been doing, whether it was for Spotify or Twitch or MailChimp or Dropbox or more recent work with Bose or Disney, we're actually getting those companies to understand that design is an agent of change. And the purpose of design is to help you imagine, to create a better future, and then use all the skills of design and increasingly other things like finance, financial analysis, portfolio management, management consulting to help your company get to that future as quickly as possible. So that's been the shift from branding, which is dramatically changing. I mean, now all the agencies are jumping in that game. And now AI is jumping in that game, and management consultants are jumping in the branding game. That game has got to change. And I'll let those guys figure out what they're going to do. We are moving, and we took dynamite to the old company and blew it up. So we are hell-bent on working with companies who need to change.
I want to pause on this, because that's massive to say dynamite to the old company. I mean, this is the company that literally branded Robin Hood. I mean, like, there's so many incredible branding projects that Collins has done. I mean, the thing I fell in love with is your new line, or maybe it's an old line, I'm not sure, but I came across it in Cannes.
It's a new one.
Making your future so irresistible it becomes inevitable. Mm-hmm. I fucking love that. I think that's incredible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think design companies can get a bit of stick, as we'd say in the UK, for saying things that don't make granular sense. Saying agents of change, or saying, you know, transformation, that can get lost in so many other companies and the way that they would describe that. How does a client arrive at Collins? How do they know that it's the time to go to Collins and say?
Yeah, I'm not blowing up the company. The company is there.
Okay.
The company's doing well and we're thriving, thank goodness. And fortunately we have so much more business. We turned down most of the things, or a lot of things that come our way. The company's thriving. What I'm saying is we had to blow up a lot of the 20th century thinking tools that were no longer services in the 21st century. You know, we're dealing with new order problems. We have to have new order thinking. You know, form follows function, less is more, problem solving. Those are all terms, some of them from the 19th century. And as if there's gravity. We're not in the problem-solving business. We're in the problem-seeking business. Form doesn't follow function. Form follows fantasy. Facts are interesting, but imagination creates possibilities. So the words we use either expand possibilities or they limit them. And I'm interested in language to expand possibilities, because the future is changing and moving so rapidly, we had to develop a new way of creating our work that moved much more quickly and much more, and with much more agility and much more responsiveness to the kind of futures that the world is looking for, particularly with our clients.
Where does that end? How do you measure? So like, when have you seen this happen in the last 6 months where a company has gone from X to Y, mm-hmm. and you go, that right there is transformation because somebody seeked out a problem? Can you think of an example?
So there's a company in the Midwest that was called, get a load of this for a sexy name, ready? Therma Holding. Boy.
Sounds hot.
Therma, yeah, Therma Holding. Their boring name hid a remarkable wrench-turning company that does bathing, heating, air conditioning, plumbing, energy, the kinds of things you need to make sure your business isn't burning money through the misuse of energy. Mm. So you're incredibly wow. complex heating and air conditioning systems. They had a series of companies they had purchased all around North America that were best of breed. These are wrench-turning businesses, mm. not particularly sexy in a world of e-commerce, right? Or in e-business. What we recognized in the process of making companies more efficient using energy, they were actually making zero carbon buildings. What people don't realize is the amount of carbon that's put into the atmosphere, it isn't automobiles, it's architecture and buildings. Ooh. That's where all the carbon is coming from. Really? Not all, the vast majority of it. So you can control the amount of energy that a building puts off, you can really solve the world's carbon problems.
Jesus.
And what we realized and what they realized is you're the answer that the world is looking for, but you're not telling the story and you're not aggregating your business and you're not aggregating your services in a way that tells that story. And so instead of saving energy, what we were about was amplifying efficiency. What we know how to do is crazily amplify the energy efficiency of your building. And that changed. And they had this collection of incredible wrench-turning companies all over the United States. And we rebranded them as legions, or a legion of companies that is creating a new, more energy efficient future.
Wow.
And the company took off. New name, new strategy, new vision for the future.
What I like about that is that you've
and by the way, the logo was a result of that reimagination of the future. Yeah. We didn't do the logo first. We figured out, what does the future need? It's pretty simple. We do something extraordinary. Yeah. The world needs this. How is it that what we do can be aggregated, organized
yeah.
with a story to answer what the world is needing? And so they've done the first zero carbon like hospital, they've been the first zero carbon airport. And so they're off to the races.
Wow.
And so that's what's interesting. That's transformation.
Yeah. And it's again, it's
and the logo's speaking. Pretty cool too.
Yeah.
But for us to be able to work, that's the true big view, in my view, of design, mm-hmm. which is design as a lever for not what we make, but what we help make possible.
Yeah. This is what you were saying when we had the LinkedIn debate about design agencies, sorry, ad agencies creating design departments, and like the how reductive that even that statement in itself is.
Well, they call them studios.
Right.
And the minute they call them studios, then you know they're exotic menials making something look better.
Yeah.
That's fine. There's a need for that in advertising agencies. I've worked in really good ones.
Yeah.
And they all have production studios. But that's not what, that's only one. That's the craft and design. And that's important because everything has to be well crafted. But advertising agencies will generally mess that up because that's what they think design. Then think of it as fussy art direction instead of, you know, a plan to make a better future.
I want to go back to Collins in what you've discovered. The word community comes up a lot.
Yeah.
What did you discover to make you think, actually, hold on, we could be doing something very different here? What was that?
Well, each of those communities that I was in, whether it was college studying graphic communication design or my own company that I started out of school or at Footcone or then later at Ogilvy, which has thousands of people in their New York City, their global headquarters, an amazing agency. Mm. And then certainly then going to Davos and all of a sudden you have thousands of the world's leaders in a town in Switzerland for a week. That those are different kinds of communities, all with an ambition to try to use whatever talents, ambition, resources, intelligence, connections, conversations that they can have to help make the world a better place.
Yeah.
And so what I began to realize is the kind of march that I had led from wearing a cap. Like, I'm not just going to have one scarf. I'm going to have five, you know, to wanting to, you know, at 13 coming to New York and say, I'm going to live there. Mm. It's kind of been a march, just like, you know, and a march is left, right, left, right. And you want to get somewhere, right? A march is really good for getting you across, you know, difficult terrain in the middle of a battle, right? You have the soldiers, you got to get them across no man's land and you march. Mm-hmm. And I march. I marched for much of my career. And what I began to realize is the things that I really enjoy in community, once you're in a community and you're having conversation, the march stops. And if you continue to do it, then you'll march right over all the really incredible things that could happen. That's what I was concerned about. When I went back to Cannes and all I saw were people marching to this and marching to that and marching to this and blaring techno and blaring bad music. And just it used to be an elegant conversation. Now it's just a blasting, screeching march. Yeah. And so my only metaphor is I'm not particularly interested in marches anymore. I'm interested in a waltz. Mm. And a waltz is really interesting, is because when you're, have you done ballroom dancing?
No, okay. I've been in a musical, but yep. I've not done ballroom dancing.
Okay. Well,
I've danced.
2 points for you. Yeah. But a waltz is great because when you're dancing with someone, you have to pay attention to them, you have to pay attention to the room, you have to listen to the music, and you're dancing. And the purpose of a waltz isn't to get you across a terrain. The purpose of a waltz is a waltz.
The dance itself.
The dance is the purpose. The purpose of a conversation is the conversation.
Yeah.
And you've been in great conversations where you've changed, right?
Yeah.
And you're really enjoying yourself. If someone has an agenda, does that feel like a really interesting conversation?
No,
it's not. You never know where a waltz is going to go. You do the waltz. And so I'm much more interested in the kinds of community making that can happen around the waltz because you're in the conversation, so you can enjoy the conversation. But if something comes out of it, great. If something doesn't come out of it, great.
I like the almost stoic mentality there of like, this is a dance. Life is a dance.
It is.
And it's all a bit, I was about to plug my own brand in there saying all a bit unknown.
But it's the same thing. There's a reason in Cinderella why she falls in love with the prince in the dance, in a waltz. You fall in love with people. You just, with that music, particularly Strauss, The waltz was considered the height of European culture in Vienna. If you see pictures, you see paintings from those periods, or if you take a camera and you look at what happens when people are waltzing, it's so elegant. And people fall in love with each other when they're dancing. So it spawns these interesting relationships. And that's what the community building, you know, was for us when we did this stuff. It's one of the reasons why I'm so glad that you showed up at our place in Cannes. You know, Cannes fine. Cannes has good, all those screeching pavilions that are yelling and blasting. That's fine. I didn't want to participate in that anymore. And I remember the kind of conversations I used to have where you'd meet somebody famous. Like I met John Haggerty sitting on a bench at the Crozet. No, actually at the Carlton Hotel.
Yeah.
I couldn't do that now.
No.
Kids who are in their 20s could never do that now because Haggerty's at an incredibly expensive hotel. It's 45 minutes out of town. Mm. And you can't get into the Carlton unless you have a room there. Rooms are thousands of dollars a night. You can't go anywhere unless you buy a ticket.
Yeah.
So if you're a kid, you don't have access to anybody. So I said, can we change that? Mm. And we got this beautiful, you were there. 10 bedrooms, 20 rooms, a garden, a walled garden. That gate was 3 stories tall. And all of a sudden you're in a place that was built in the 19th century.
Yes.
For a garden party in France on the Riviera. And no logos. We made everyone take their lanyards off. Mm. So you had to meet who people were. And you couldn't go, are you a senior? But, you know.
Yeah.
So we forced people into conversations. Mm. And then people came Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday. And we had amazing people
yeah.
show up. what was interesting, by Tuesday, people said, hey, can I come back tomorrow?
Mm.
And they just hung out for breakfast, lunch, and then they stayed for the live music performances we had at night. And it got to the point where Ogilvy had called because they won Network of the Year, and they said, we heard your place is fantastic. Like, a bunch of people have been there. I'm like, yeah. Can we have our agency party there? I'm like, I was an executive there. I'm like, of course. So, you know, their people came and they had a giant pool party at Colin's house on like Saturday.
Really?
It was fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. It was. I welcomed them in the house and then I went upstairs and I did
went to sleep.
No, I'm exhausted. But they had an incredible lunch and they had an incredible pool party.
Wow.
And they're dear friends. And they had rented this other, I think, fabulous, expensive place. And they said, we heard your place is better. And it was. So I said, sure. Come on over.
It wasn't just visually better or even like aesthetically. It was spiritually better. Like, it was the most densely populated collection of human beings that were madly talented and diversely talented, but they all shared the same thing in common, which I think was naked curiosity. Everybody that you spoke to was interested in you.
That's right.
And it wasn't, you know, we were saying earlier.
And no lanyards.
Lanyards. And you couldn't go,
oh, you're some junior vice president or your CMO. Or
yeah, Scott Galloway. How do I open that? But that's what you felt, right? And you're there. And you felt, you know, it sounds cheesy, seen, heard, but you felt as important as the next person.
You should. Well, because you are.
Right.
So I bumped into the president of DNAD, my friend Jack. She said, and she's Scottish. I'm not going to try to do a Scottish burr, but she said, there's these two young kids from Glasgow that are here. So what are they doing here? I'm like, I invited them, but they aren't well known. I'm like, that's why I invited them. I'm like, because they're emerging voices. I'm fascinated by gifted misfits.
Yeah.
All the time. And why would you only want to invite, you know, these parties where it's only the CMO or it's only the CEO or it's only the junior vice president of fear, doubt, and worry? I'm like, I was bored by that.
Yeah.
And so we invited. What we did is we sent out an invitation on our newsletter and we didn't tell anybody who the famous people were who were coming. We had crazy famous people as speakers, but we didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
So if they were interested in, they were curious, they'd come.
Yes.
And so what ends up happening is the kids who don't have anything, they don't have any money, they came because it didn't cost anything. So we had tons of young people showing up.
Yeah.
And when they found out who was speaking there, people thought, found out, well, why didn't you tell us that Scott Galloway was speaking? I'm like, because I didn't have to, because I said, I think we're going to have an interesting afternoon.
Yeah.
So it ends up happening. All these kids who just said, I'm curious, had no agenda except to hang out with us at the house, met amazing people.
It was incredible.
So their curiosity, I didn't announce who the list of people who were coming until we were all booked up. And then on the third day, I'm like, here's who's coming. And Cindy Gallup spoke, and Michael Kasson spoke, and Scott Galloway spoke, and Marcus Collins spoke, and a lot of other famous people spoke.
He was incredible.
Who I don't want to like talk about. But what was interesting is it rewarded all the people who signed up without knowing who was going to be there. And most of them were young people who were just sort of starting out. And they're like, there's that famous person. Like, yeah, you should go and chat. And so I loved doing that.
Yeah.
We had a great time. But the secret got out by Thursday about what we were doing. And
I think it'll be a lot harder to protect the secret next year. Mm-hmm. But there'll definitely be a new strategy, perhaps.
Yeah.
I
actually loved the house and we wanted to make it look like a garden party. People thought it was my house. I was like,
you'll take it. I mean, you were on the balcony at some points. Welcome.
Yeah, well, nice. But I think what that meant was, I think people felt welcomed.
Yeah.
I mean, they felt like they were made to feel like they belonged.
Mm.
We made sure everyone had food. We made sure everyone was treated equally. We made sure everyone was having a good time. Yeah. We gave everybody fans because it was hot as hell. We wanted to be pretty egalitarian and welcoming. And if you wanted to stay for talk and then leave, or then come and stay all day long, hang out at the pool, have food, you could do that as well. It was no agenda except to meet people and learn something and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, and thank you so much. It was incredible. I want to just quickly move back to Collins quickly. I asked this question because I'm curious to know where you go with this.
Yep.
If everything that you're planning in Volume 2 Collins goes to plan,
mm-hmm.
what will be different about Collins in 12 to 18 months?
A number of things, but I knew this. If you don't plan to reinvent yourself, the market will.
Mm.
And I'm seeing the market reinventing the old brand game pretty quickly. Yeah. That old game is running out of road. We still do brand work. We do brand work with some of the leading brands in the world. Our clients include everyone from Disney to Blackstone to The Gap. And we've been blessed by those clients. I think we're going to be different in a number of ways. I think what we're doing is we're realizing that we have an incredible, or we're not being in business with my partner, Leland Mashmeyer, now for going into 17 years, Lee was my co-founder, he's now our CEO, is that we're starting to realize that the community of people, not unlike yours, that you've nurtured, is actually our greatest delight and our greatest source of strength, opportunity, creativity, resources, imagination, creative muscle. And so one of the things that we're doing is we bought a 5-acre property up in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. It's in the woods. It's by the water. The entire company is going to be there in 2 weeks for a week just to talk about the future and go on bicycles and go swimming and go on clam bakes. And on that Cape Cod, that's the part of Cape Cod where the modernists came in the 1940s and 50s, and they built future-facing architecture that was connected to nature. Buckminster Fuller built his first practical geodesic dome there, and Walter Gropius brought people like Marcel Breuer and Mies van der Rohe, and they built incredible experiments in architecture out there. So we're in that tradition exploring that. So the entire company is going there in a couple of weeks. I'm taking 22 people to Ireland, and friends of mine who are in movie productions, friends in Hollywood, writers, colleagues of mine, some members of my team, and we're going to understand the nature of storytelling. And in Ireland for a week, we're going
the Book of Kells.
Yeah. We're going to go visit. We're actually going to spend a day at Trinity College with some cultural historians. Wow. And cultural anthropologists and Irish historians and Irish storytellers. And we're spending the day at Trinity College with the Book of Kells. We're going up to Galway to go along the wild Atlantic coast. Wow. And we're basically traveling, visiting writers, artists, storytellers, and sort of ancient sites in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And doing that in October. In November, we're leading a trip to Bhutan.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Slightly. With our colleagues and people who are fascinated by history, philosophy, and religion and spirituality and the incredible architecture and stories that come up from that part of the world. We're staying at Tiger's Nest. Have you ever seen pictures of Bhutan about a monastery that's on the side of a cliff?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where we're going.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
This is like a lot of inspiration, like cultural density. Is everyone exposed to that? How does that work?
Well, bring our teams, we document it, we bring our clients with us, we bring our friends with us. So it's a constant conversation. And we'll go back to Bhutan, we'll go back to Ireland. So we're doing that. Then we're also doing these things that my team is running called Behind the Scenes. Yeah. Behind the Scenes, we do it in San Francisco, we do it in New York, and we get people to come, they have to give us 7-minute talk about something they fucked up. Something that was an abysmal failure. There's no video. No one can talk about it.
Really?
You can't tape it. What happens behind the scenes stays behind the scenes.
I love that.
And so people, we heard some of the most amazing, famous product designers and graphic designers and creative people have said, this is where I really screwed up. And they talk about a failure and what they learned and how they have recovered or how they didn't and what they're learning. So that's, we have maybe 8 or 9 speakers.
Wow.
In an evening. We've had media people. We had one time a really well-known YouTube celebrity, crazy well-known YouTube celebrity came in and he talked about something that was a disaster that he turned, how he flipped it into a really good story.
I love that.
But that's all quiet. And and if someone pulls out their phone, they get kicked out. And then they get go.
Oh my God.
You cannot.
That's so good.
Because what's end up happening? So we do this, so we have this talk, it lasts for about an hour. Mm. And we have then beer or lemonade in the summer. And people stay and just talk for hours.
Wow.
And they just talk to each other. And we also, of course, we have coffee house, which we do on Sundays. Mm. We open the door, we serve chewy coffee, donuts, bagels, croissants from all the bakeries in around in Brooklyn. We open the door about at about noon, and people just hang out until about six.
So what I'm hearing, like, you're creating moments of, like, creative transmission. Like, people can learn from each other and, like, from any different parts of the world that you or they might find inspirational. Oh, by the way, I'd love to know what your fuck-up story would have been. I wish I asked you that.
Oh, they are legion. I have monetized my fuck-ups. I am a walking collection of Band-Aids, string, tape, and fuck-ups. This is why I surround myself with people who are really good. They do not fuck up, because I am a walking accident waiting to happen. Just keep me away from the matches.
Yeah, I feel like Leland is definitely the opposite of the fuck up.
Leland's actually crazy, but he does a much better job of, like, presenting a more debonair finish.
I see.
Than I do, but I adore him.
No, he's
Apollo to my more Dionysian sensibilities.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Dr. Marcus Collins, they say that when I spoke to Leland afterwards.
Wasn't he great? Leland was great.
He was fucking incredible. Yeah, awesome. The way he hosted him was incredible. He was asking questions that my brain wouldn't have the IQ to ask, but I understood it. And the way they were talking it was this really rare thing where they speak in a human way. That could have been an intellectual, academic, runaway train where nobody understood a word they were saying. But it wasn't. I understood what they were saying, which is really important.
Yeah.
So, like, the way that he got the questions out of Mark, I stalked that guy afterwards and was like, holy shit, this man is very interesting.
Oh, Lee's fantastic. And Lee's able to take incredibly. So this term we love from the Supreme Court Justice, the most famous one, I think, is Oliver Wendell Holmes, said, forever seek simplicity on the far side of complexity.
Mm.
And so it means you've got to do your work. You have to really understand a topic. And once you really wrap your brain around a topic, then you can speak about it in English. All these people, people try to make simplicity really complex.
Yeah.
They try to make it opaque and they try to make it difficult. And I don't play the game.
Okay, I've got one more question I want to ask you, because this has gone past, like, so quick. It's more of a kind of maybe a spiritual question, but imagine if you had Brian Collins' 21-year-old version now.
Yeah.
You are entering the industry and you want to future-proof your career and have the illustrious, amazing time that you've had. What advice would you give that human being?
Nothing.
Nothing.
I would tell them nothing. Nothing. I would not tell that person, like, just go at it. The world, it's so interesting when it comes to creativity. When you look at a career, it's like looking at the beginning of a project. You have no idea where it's going to go when you're looking at it out toward the horizon. Then when you get back and you say the project is done a year later, or you're halfway through your career and it's done well, or maybe it's not gone that well, or you're later in your career like I am, and I look back, I'm like, okay, some things worked out. The false logic is to look backwards and say, well, I always knew that was going to happen. Or there's no way you can. There's no way. It's a series of serendipitous moments, lucky chances, taking advantage of a win that suddenly happens. And what I do know is this, and which is why I would never give myself any advice, is you need to make the dumbass, biggest, stupidest mistakes you'll ever make. You have to make them. If you don't make them, you won't have a career. Your career is made in the mistakes. Your career is made in the intelligence you apply to a recovery. That's where you learn. That's where you gain muscle mass. That's where your brain grows. That's where the synapses connect. Because if you don't get yourself out of a problem, your career's over. And so if you try to avoid the mistakes, you learn. No, you learn nothing from success. You're great. You're great. You're great. You're the best. You're so good. What? That's why when people criticize our work, and it's hard for we've done some really well-known work and we're better known. So because we're better known, people might not criticize our work because they'll think, oh, they criticize the work, then, you know, it might not play in my favor. But I loved it when we did Spotify, we weren't well known, or we did Dropbox and people attacked Dropbox. They attacked MailChimp and we weren't really well known. And then we became well known because, wow, maybe they're right. Yeah. I like it when people, like, criticize. Otherwise, how are you going to learn? Otherwise, you're just in a house of mirrors.
Yeah.
So mistakes, dumbass, stupid. I cannot believe I made that mistake. You learn from it, and it's worth it if you can pull one thing out of it. Like, what did I learn in this thing? Mm. There's always something in the worst disaster that you can go, oh, and probably too many designers are looking for, you know, the cloud in every silver lining. Mm. It is a privilege to be in this profession.
Yeah.
And after a while, these people are just whining, oh, they didn't like my logo. Make another one. They didn't like that. Make another one. Just get over yourself. So that's why I would never, never tell my 21-year-old self, like, every mistake you're going to make, you have to make it. The mistake is to think it's horrible. Mistake would be not to get back up. That's the mistake.
Wow. This has been way more than I was expecting.
I'm so sorry.
No.
You have to get out more.
No, but genuine, Brian, like you mentioned the word privilege. This has been a genuine privilege to just sit with you and talk. Like, honestly, your brain is...
Well, you have to come to Cannes next year.
Well, we're going to have to...
And hang out at the house and like have some food and hang out with some famous people who I'm not going to mention who they are because I dropped names.
I heard Taylor Swift coming.
My crew will have to follow up behind me with like a dustpan and broom as I drop the names. But we're not going to do it. But no. I'll tell you, it's really interesting when those kinds of people show up. And kids who just starting out their careers and people who are billionaires. That's interesting.
Yeah. Brian, thank you. Thank you for everything you're doing. And thank you for coming to see me.
It's great to see you.
I love this.
We didn't mess up. See?
Woo! Like
all the three cameras.
Cold mics.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.